This lecture was given in Auckland on the 13th of August 1974 and is the seventh in the series. The title, The Body of the Emotions Built of Astral Matter, and the lecturer is Mr. Geoffrey Hodgson.
And friends, as you have heard, we are to study the emotional nature and the emotional or astral body of man, ourselves in fact. Perhaps I might open our study together by repeating the theosophical or a theosophical edition, a description of man himself. How is he described? Concerning the chart, remember that stratifying leads to error, since the planes of nature and vehicles of man are not one above the other, but all occupying the same space and interpenetrating. The outer triangle is a symbol of the threefold divine being of the universe, and man, since he is a reproduction thereof, containing the same presence, is shown by a similar triangle at the appropriate part of the major triangle of the seven planes of nature. Man, then, is described as that being in whom highest spirit, the monad, and lowest matter, these are bodies, are united by intellect. Man's spiritual self, that's the monad, perpetually unfolds potential capacities, this being the result of his existence. They're unfolding, growing all the time. This process of unfoldment culminates in the attainment of perfected manhood or adeptship. The method, as you doubtless know, and as we will be studying later on, the method of human evolution is by means of successive lives here in physical bodies on this earth, or, if you like, reincarnation or rebirth. Further, it is taught for us that our conditions, human conditions and experiences, are the results of human conduct under the law of cause and effect. You and I are what we are now because this we have made of ourselves. Human conditions and experiences are the results of human conduct under the law of cause and effect, or karma. Simply put, kindness brings health and happiness. Cruelty brings disease and misery. Next very important statement we find is that this process of human evolution can be hastened. The kingdom of heaven, it is said, can be taken by storm. This calls for self-training, regular meditation, and selfless service. In consequence, century by century, a perfect man arises, the rare flowering of the human race. It is taught that perfect men and women, adepts, do actually now exist on this earth. A subject also perhaps we'll be studying together in due course. Then finally, from my notes here, ages ago, And ever since, certain adepts have shared their discovered wisdom and knowledge with humanity. This wisdom, divine wisdom, is called in Sanskrit from the remotest times Brahma Vidya and Theosophia in Greek, meaning the wisdom of Brahma, the supreme deity, or Theosophia, divine wisdom, or as it still is called, Theosophy in English. Such, briefly and in outline, friends, is a theosophical definition of man. And tonight we're going to look at the teachings concerning our emotional nature or our astral bodies. Now, what does that word astral really mean? Of course, we know starry, or of translucent nature. And I suppose that the theosophists and others of the Middle Ages gave the astral body this kind of name when they saw it and discovered that the matter of which it is composed is self-luminous, so that the whole astral body shines, is self-shining, really. And so they said, oh, it's starry. And this name, for a long time, has been given to the kingdom, next above our physical, the astral plane, as you see there, and to the astral body. It may be defined as built of all those vibrating forces that lie between the intensest physical activity in the atomic etheric state, between that and the lowest mental activity, the seventh division of the world of emotions. So the astral, as we'll see as we look into it together, the astral is the region, one might say, the region of the play of all feeling and desire of the human soul. Whether they're incarnate, as we are now in our bodies, or discarnate. And astral also applies to the region where all this exists, the astral plane. And yes, I might add that it is to this state of matter and consciousness, and to this vehicle, the astral body, that we will find ourselves conscious in when our physical bodies are laid aside. That's in the life after death. Well, now let us look at our subject. Briefly, to clairvoyant sight, the astral body of man is a vehicle not unlike the physical body, but surrounded by an aura of constantly moving brilliant colors. It is composed of matter of the fineness higher than that of the lightest physical matter. And therefore, by the by, it's not visible to the eyes. It's only visible to extra sensory capacities, vision. And here, in this part of our nature then, feelings, passions, desires, and other emotions are first expressed in the astral body, which acts as a kind of bridge or medium of transmission between the physical body and brain and mind and the higher self of man. Such then is the astral body. astral matter being so much finer than the physical matter interpenetrates it. And every physical atom, therefore, floats, if you like, in a sea of astral matter, which surrounds it and fills every interstice between the atoms of physical matter. So if we could see our physical world, and yes, our air, is filled with astral substance. And this is a principle known as interpenetration. And this principle makes it clear that the different realms of nature, though they are shown as one above the other, are not really separated in space. They exist about us here and now, so that to perceive and to investigate them, no movement in space is necessary. All that's required is an opening within ourselves of the senses by means of which they can be perceived. Extrasensory perception, as it is called today. The astral world, or plane, then, is thus a condition of nature rather than a locality, though it does, in the case of our planet, extend far beyond our air, right on out into space. Well, what does the astral body look like then?
Well,
it not only permeates the physical body, but it extends around it in every direction, like an ovoid cloud, if you like. But there is a portion of the astral body which is within the physical body, and another portion then which extends beyond the limits of the physical body, and this, as you know, is generally called the aura. This astral aura of each one of us is ovoid and normally about 3 or 4 times the size of the physical body. But if you see a person with astral sight, if I may use the term, then the central portion of the astral body takes the exact form of the physical body and is therefore recognizable, clearly distinguishable from the surrounding aura. So if you happen to see a person, say, discarnate, then they would always be recognizable, or out of their body during sleep, always be recognizable because of the counterpart, as it's called, of the physical body. The exact correspondence of the astral body with the physical is merely a matter of external form and doesn't involve any similarity of function at all. Doesn't involve, for instance, the functions of the various organs, heart, brain, and other parts of our body. They're not reproduced there and do not function for the body in the same way that they do here. Now, on the surface of the astral body, there are what are known as the chakras. I brought a picture. Just take one down, perhaps. I brought a picture of these vortices, wheels, or chakras on the astral body just to illustrate this part of our study. That's right, right way up. Thank you, dear. That was painted by one of our members in Christchurch, and doubtless she was painting the astral body in small of someone who had had success in yoga. For the chakras are particularly active in that picture, as you can come up and look at it after if you like. They are seven in number and situated in positions which correspond to our sacrum, the spleen, the solar plexus, the heart chakram, as you can see perhaps, one at the throat, mostly blue, one here at the forehead and right out in front of the astral body, the organ by the bioclairvoyance, and then the seventh chakram is high up at the top of the head, at the crown. Sacrum, spleen, navel if you like, heart, throat, brow, crown. Seven vibrating, spinning whirlpools, if you like. They look like funnels, open on the surface and beyond the astral body, and with tubes running back either into the spinal cord or into organs in the head. Such then, briefly, are the chakras. Then the colors, which I'm going to describe and explain a little to you. To clairvoyant sight, one of the principal features of an astral body consists of the colors, as you see there. Though the astral body is made smaller there than it would normally be, and some of the colors in a very refined and purified state are visible. These colors are constantly playing through the astral body, and they correspond to and are expressions of feelings, emotions, desires, and passions, each kind of which is expressed in the astral aura by certain specific colors. And all the known colors, and many of which are at present unknown, exist upon the higher planes of nature. But as we rise in consciousness from one plane to another, they become more and more delicate, more luminous, or if you like, could I say, higher octaves of our physical colors. Now, what are these colors? Let's look at them together and see what they express in human nature. Supposing we have them in our own auras, a clairvoyant looking at us would be able to get some idea of our habitual emotions. Well, here are some of them. It's a very big subject, friends, but I have brought a list with me of a number. First then, the reds. I'm leaving out what is not a color at all, really, black. Sometimes, unfortunately, that can be seen in an aura. Fortunately, it's very rare, and it represents, it is said, malice, hatred, and black hatred, should I say, and malice. Rare, fortunately. Red, various shades, of course. The deep red flashes, usually and possibly on a grey or black background, those red flashes represent anger. Scarlet clouds and flecks like snowflakes on the outer skin or edge of the aura, they're irritability. They're not very, very deep. They're when a person temporarily gets rather cross. But they show there, and at once, and as long as the cross feeling is being experienced, they'll be visible. And moreover, they fly out against the person, if it is one, who's aroused the crossness. But we'll come to all that later on. What other colors? Brilliant scarlet on the ordinary background of the aura indicates noble indication. noble indignation, brilliant scarlet. But there is, and said to be in many auras, a kind of lurid and sanguinary red, which sensuality in all its varieties of feeling and desire. Then we come to brown grey, a dull, hard brown grey means selfishness, which again is one of the commonest colours in the astral aura. And by the by, you notice from that picture, if you can see it, bring it forward a bit there to the edge of the platform. Thank you, dear. You notice that the artist has evidently painted some highly evolved person, and so none of these ugly colours are there, and there's none of the brown grey, dull, hard, thank you dear, brown grey of selfishness. Then there can be, yes, a mixing of brown and red, dull, almost rust colour. This means avarice, selfish avarice. It's curious that when you see it, it can be arranged in parallel bars across the astral body, almost as if the miser, this would be an extreme case, as if the miser was self-imprisoned in the bars of his or her own avariciousness. Then, greenish brown, which is sometimes lit up by scarlet flashes. What does that mean? Important. Greenish brown, lit up by deep red or scarlet flashes. There's a seat here, lady, plenty up in front. Do come. Right, all right. Well, greenish brown, lit up by deep red or scarlet flashes. What is it? Jealousy. And in the case of a normal kind of individual, there is usually some of this colour present when they are in love. And we have, I suppose, when we're in love, we have to be careful about jealousy. Quite a natural thing in a way, but quite ugly when it gets hold of a person and is strong. And yes, a great cause of suffering and sorrow as well, as you know. Then grey itself, a heavy kind of leaden grey, that means the person is depressed. This also, like the brown red of avarice, can be arranged. Yes, come along, Kathleen, here you are. Glad you got here at all, dear, come along. Lady comes a very long way. Well, grey, we were thinking about. Heavy, leaden, grey. It means the person's depressed, depression, sadness. Like the brown red of avarice, it can become, if it's serious, arranged in parallel bars, conveying the impression of a cage. People get heavily enclosed in, or clouded over by the dull grey of depression. And if we're not careful when we're in their presence, of course, it's very catching, and we have to be careful, not only that we don't catch it, but that we're helpful to them at the same time. And it is possible, of course, to drive these undesirable things, particularly depression, particularly deep sadness, partly, if not wholly, away from a person. If we come in charge with spiritual will and unselfish love for our fellow men, and we come into the presence of such a saddened person and invoke spiritual power and joy into them and their aura, we can often disperse the grave. And you'll find that such people, recipients, will say, "Oh, I always feel so much brighter when such and such a person visits me." Others will say, "Oh, I'm always rather saddened and depressed when so-and-so comes to see me." Well, if we could watch these processes, we'd understand them and, yes, guard ourselves against them. Then fear also is grey, a kind of heavy, livid grey. And this also can spread too, and very easily. All of these colours, as we'll see a little later, are highly contagious. And that's why it is in Theosophy students are advised and warned to take care of their thoughts and feelings, particularly feelings and adverse ones, because we carry with us the influence of our own makeup, our own nature. And one like this, real fear, livid, frightful, grey, this can spread very rapidly. And can, yes, can cause panic from one to the another and sweep people along, yes, into a kind of panic. Then we move into crimson. If it's dull and heavy, it's rather a selfish love. But if it's rose-coloured, it's unselfish love. Particularly, yes, particularly if there's no tint, or dare I say taint, of brown in the roseate hue, then that rose colour, quite pure, would be representing in the person unselfish love. And when it's, when it's exceptionally brilliant and perhaps tinged with lilac, like that aura there you see, then it means spiritual love for all humanity. The great ideal expression of love for all that exists. More colours? Yes, orange. Orange is said to be the colour of pride and heightened ambition, whilst the ordinary yellow is the colour of intellect, as you see round and in the head of this figure here. That shows the action of the intellect. And it varies from a deep, dull tint through brilliant gold to clear and luminous primrose yellow, all according to the type and activity of the person's intellect. Dull, of course, dull yellow ochre colour, that implies the direction of intellectual faculties for selfish purposes. Primrose yellow, a clear, clear primrose yellow, denotes intellect, intelligence, devoted to spiritual purposes. Gold, however, indicates pure intellect applied to philosophy or mathematics. Now green in general varies greatly in its significance, needs to be studied very carefully and interpreted with correctness. For example, a grey green, somewhat, yes, I have to say this, somewhat slimy grey green in the aura shows deceit and cunning, a very unpleasant colour in the aura. Emerald green, versatility, ingenuity, resourcefulness. And if it's a clear green, applied unselfishly, in the service of others. whether in the home or out in life. But a wonderful colour, by the by, is pale, luminous, bluish green. Deep sympathy, profound compassion. And there, the person thus developed must be on watch. For if they suddenly find themselves in the presence of a case of grave need, suffering immediately before them, sometimes their profound compassion can be so strong that it overpowers them and they can't act, cannot act to help. And so deep compassion needs to be, as it were, directed with common sense and immediate effectiveness. That's the pale, luminous, blue-green, deep sympathy and compassion. It's generally across the throat or a little lower down in the aura. Then they say a bright apple green in the aura always seems to accompany strong vitality. And this brings us to the blues. Blue, like you see it there in the upper part of the aura, dark and clear, that's religious feeling, or what we would call devotion, leading to devotion. Deep religious feeling. But it's liable, of course, to be tainted by many other qualities, thus becoming any shade from indigo or a deep violet to a muddy grey blue. If, for example, a person's religion is tinted very much with fear, and they're afraid of what's going to happen to them in the hereafter, they don't have a great deal of faith in the love of our Heavenly Father, of His Son, our Lord Christ, and how the everlasting arms are always open to receive us. But if we've been brought up in a religious faith, well, we are held by fear of the hereafter, then the colour in the aura, the blue, will be darkened into a kind of muddy grey blue. Light blue, I don't know whether it shows there, it probably does. Light blue, such as ultramarine or cobalt, that's devotion to a noble spiritual ideal. And it's a very uplifted state. If there's a tint of violet, this indicates a mixture of affection and devotion. There can be a kind of luminous lilac blue, usually accompanied by sparkling golden stars up above the head. This is the higher spirituality, and the stars are an expression as thought forms of lofty spiritual aspiration. When we meditate, when we pray intelligently, unselfishly, lifting ourselves wholly up to the highest we know within and above us, then this will show itself with these colors shining out, displacing other colors in the aura, and above the head there will be these uprushing, brilliant stars. Joy shows itself as a general brightening and a radiance of both mental and astral bodies. And as when a person's really very, very happy in joy, you can tell it there's a kind of rippling, peculiar rippling of the size of the astral body. Cheerfulness shows itself in a modified bubbling form of this ripple, and also expresses a kind of steady serenity. Now we come to the functions of the astral body. What does it do for us? Well, there are three main functions of our astral body, so it is taught. They are to make sensation possible, to serve as a bridge between mind and physical matter, and third, to act as an independent vehicle of consciousness and action. Concerning this first, to make sensation possible, I want just to share with you some teaching that has become available from more medical sources. And there we learn that emotional contagion is the answer to the question which has been in many of people's minds, especially about little children or tiny babies. How do they get these kind of feelings? They can't think negative thoughts, but a very well-informed woman doctor, Dr. Dunbar, states the youngest infant can be infected with fear, anger, or disgust, even more easily than with measles. The results, she adds, appear in little homely ways long before they develop into major tragedies. But, she adds, by the same token, the child can catch love and trust and respect. And of course, yes, I should say, all of these influences around children, before, at, after birth, and as they grow up, mold their characters and set going certain tendencies in them, which may be there in embryo, as it were, but could get stirred up. For good, if they're full of love and happiness and joy and unselfishness, or the opposite. So apparently we carry a good deal of responsibility for this property of astral matter. It's contagious. So that the exposure of a child to violent emotions in the first year of its life, especially when that emotion is accompanied, unfortunately it is, by violent action, then this can leave scars, which can endure for a lifetime. They can't be scars, of course, like we have on our skins and deeper on our physical body, but they are marks which can be seen. And in clairvoyant diagnosis of disease, especially of mysterious diseases in the adult, sometimes the causes can be traced back to what can only be described as scars or taints built in there into the astral body very, very early in life. A child does not have to be in the room or actually hear the words of a quarrel, for example, or to see the action. It's in the very atmosphere, you see, and they catch, could I say, they catch the vibrations. Children are very sensitive. They are sensitive, much more so as a rule than other people. And some grown people also catch vibrations and can sense when they go into a room or into a home whether there's harmony, peace, and love there, or whether there's discordance and bickering and quarreling, do you see? All these things, friend, they're tremendous forces, you see, and can leave a lasting impression. Not only, this is curious, I know, not only upon the subtle bodies of others in relationship with them, but even, as it were, on the walls of the room in the house. So, from this, though I'm not preaching, and Theosophy doesn't preach very much, it does tell us, doesn't it, how careful we ought to be with regard to our emotions. Now that third function. I've time to talk to you a bit about the third function, which you remember was to act as an independent vehicle of consciousness and action. How does that work? Well, during ordinary waking consciousness, that means whilst the brain and the senses are wide awake, the powers of the astral senses may be brought into action. And some of these powers correspond to the senses and powers of action possessed by the physical body. And by the by, they generally reach the physical body via the chakras and the nerve centers and glands, which correspond to the position of the chakras. The change in the emotional condition and the astral body begins with the body in general first. Then the chakram is altered in its spin, in its shape, in its function. Then that affects the flow of the life force deep into the body of the person, and then they can begin to be affected adversely or favorably in the case of favorable influences. Now, unlike the etheric double about which I was speaking the other week, during sleep or trance, it is possible for the astral body to separate itself from the physical body and move about and function freely on its own plane according to the degree of development. And this is part of our sleep life and our dream life about which Theosophy has a great deal to say to us. And furthermore, with regard to this third function, to serve as a bridge and a vehicle, it is possible to develop the powers of the astral body so that a person may become consciously and deliberately, at any time he chooses, he may be able to leave his physical body and pass with unbroken consciousness into his astral body, and then move about at will in the superphysical world. This is one of the siddhis or powers which is developed by the successful practice of yoga as a part of life. Then we might say that, yes, I must add this, after death, the consciousness which we are using now, for example, through our brains and ears and eyes and so on, after physical death, the consciousness withdraws itself into the astral body, and a life varying greatly in intensity and duration, dependent upon a number of factors which may be transferred to astral plane life. It's again very, very important that we should endeavor to maintain a good control of our emotional and mental natures during life. If we don't, then when what I've just described happens, we find ourselves out of the body, no longer having a physical body, in the astral and mental bodies, and no longer with the stabilizing influence of the heavy inert flesh, then we find ourselves a prey to certain qualities which we have developed during life. And these may cause very grave difficulties, not only because of what we've done, but what we've had to suffer and what we've been subjected to and what we've had to endure, perhaps from childhood, conditions in our emotional and mental nature. Fortunately, there exists on the mental and astral planes, organized assistance for such people who die in all kinds of troubles. Individuals and groups of helpers do actually efficiently administer to those who have died physically after psychological distress and prolonged restrictions, suffered before final freedom from the body comes to them. And this wonderful protective healing and, yes, and becoming treatment helps very greatly for those who arrive in great need. And many do. Think of all the catastrophes and the sudden catastrophes under which, where it's a mass trouble or a group trouble or even an individual thrown suddenly out of the body, totally unprepared. Shock, terror, fear, and all the built-in conditions in the character, all these can cause the individual to find themselves in a state of absolute terror. Or perhaps a person may have lain for many months or even years in increasing debility, almost paralyzed bodily state, an awakening to the superphysical life where no such paralysis exists. This can be a shock. There is, of course, a wonderful freedom as well from the sick body, but the astral elemental, that means the group consciousness in the astral body, can have a somewhat warped and distressed condition and view of life. In consequence, that person would have difficulty in adapting to normal after-death life. Many such sufferers are cared for and even saved from very trying and possibly dangerous psychological conditions of disturbance, stress, and other problems of self-orientation. So, numbers of people thus recover consciousness after death and find themselves in very great need. Largely psychological, caused by life's experiences, and yes, their reactions to them, tragic and prolonged as they may often have been. But fortunately, I repeat, many individuals and groups are continuously at work in this field. Prayers for those who have died can be very helpful indeed. And this is a work upon which any one of us can engage. And there are theosophical books which guide us and even call us to participate in such organized work, which, as you may know, most of you, is called Invisible Helping. And there are large groups of invisible helpers who treat sufferers who die in deep psychological trouble and cure them, restore them. They might, and this would be a wrong word, but their atmosphere and the attitude they bring might be called hospitals for souls. They bring out people of the almost paralyzed state of mind in which they die, perhaps due to paralysis of the body, which has continued for a long time before death. And these helpers get hold of them, shelter them from a time, even shelter them away for a time, with others bright and cheerful, and guide and help and teach very much as if they were children again, so that they may adapt themselves to the life after death. So you see, friends, psychological suffering endured whilst on earth isn't thrown off immediately at death, but can go on with a person, even though the body is no longer there. And so, not only is there a wonderful opportunity for helping now, but after death as well. And at night we are taught that if we are so moved and filled with love and compassion for those who are suffering, our last thought during the last hour or so is, when I leave my body tonight in sleep, I will go helping those in need. It's a very noble and practically helpful ideal. Wonderful, beautiful thought, don't you think? So there, my time is up, friends, I must leave our subject of the astral body of man, his or her vehicle in which the emotions find their first expression, in which they arise, and in and over which they show as colors, each color representing this or that kind of feeling, emotion, desire, passion, as we have seen. And from such a study, we are encouraged, are we not, to try, not only for our own sake, to build in only happiness-giving and purified emotions, but also for the sake of everybody else. For indeed, as I read, emotions are very contagious indeed. Thank you. Friends, perhaps I'd better offer some answer to your questions, always remembering that theosophy has no dogmas whatever and merely offers ideas for us to consider quite freely. I can, of course, in answering, try to answer in the correct theosophical way, but I cannot allow any impression of dogmatism whatever. When one is giving healing and sees certain colors with the patient, are these the colors that they require? I should have to be present in order to advise you. More likely to be the colors in the patient's aura, I should say. How was all this knowledge discovered? And how does it relate to the... some word can't be read of the association of the body of teaching in the Bible? Well, the answer briefly to that is by the awakening and scientific use of the necessary occult faculties. Physical faculties for physical plane matter, astral clairvoyance for the astral, mental, and so on, going greater and greater and deeper as the realm of principles and laws and interior powers and intelligences are concerned. And the whole of the resultant knowledge has come down to us throughout the ages, thus discovered by adept seers, checked and counter-checked down thousands upon thousands of years, so that we have today a certain body of ideas offered to us to help us in our lives. Furthermore, theosophy seems to me to add, it's possible for us to check it all for ourselves if we care to take the trouble to develop similar faculties. The whole thing is subject to the scientific method of investigation, you know, which is rechecked observations and experiments objectively recorded with absolute honesty and without fear or favor. If in that spirit, and you care to develop the necessary faculties, open those chakras, for example, then you yourself can verify or not the teachings you have received. Does the sight of the aura arise as an image in the mind's eye? Depends on the faculty you're using. Normally, if it's clairvoyance or ESP, it will be in front of you. Say the person is there, you see, well then everything about them and their aura will be visible outside of you and in front of you. By the by, might I just say there, friends, that this is a faculty that should never thus be used. Never. Just as one would never read another person's letters, so one would never peep or peer into another person's aura. Iron rule, golden rule, should I say. So no, friend, not in the mind's eye, on the place where it is, most likely. All depending on the kind of vision. When a soul suffers prolonged illness on earth, passes into the spirit world, could this be a result from a previous incarnation? And being so, would free of suffering in the spirit world, one can't, the second part can't be affirmed, but certainly the first part can. According to what I read out to you of the Theosophical teaching, or St. Paul puts it, whatever a man sows, that shall he also reap. And the Lord Buddha, each man's life, the outcome of his former living is. And our Lord Christ on so many occasions affirmed this law of cause and effect. Then yes, everything that comes to us, every experience, happiness or giving or otherwise, is the result of our own conduct. It's a reaping from past sowing. Quotation comes into my mind where our Lord himself says, it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one jot or one tittle of the law to fail. Judge not that ye be not judged. Be merciful that ye may obtain mercy. And whatsoever ye would that men should do unto you, do ye unto them also. And in that measure in which ye mete it out to others, so shall it be measured to you again. For this, he said, like a great final utterance, confirmation, for this is the law and the prophets. Now that runs through all scriptures, all great philosophical and spiritual teachers, and is at the heart of every world religion. The law of cause and effect. Here's another question on the same lines. If a young girl suffers, I'm not going to read out that suffering, friend, if you don't mind, suffers in a very terrible way, can she be accused of reaping what she sows? Don't say that, friends. We don't accuse. Quite the contrary. We sympathize ever more and more deeply. We'd never dream of accusing. Nevertheless, as philosophers, we'd have to think the thing out, as you are evidently doing, friend. And theosophy would answer us, yes, certainly. It's reaping as we have sown. If the physical spleen is not healthy, can one help it by contacting healing forces, placing the hands over it and willing wholeness of health into it? Yes, definitely. Make sure your body, hands absolutely clean, your motive absolutely clean and absolutely pure, and link yourself with the highest sources of power, our Lord Jesus Christ, for example, invoke his power that it may flow through your hands for the healing of the sick. Yes, a possibility. Does the consciousness travel with the astral or mental body normally? Yes. When we leave the body at sleep, for example, yes. The egoic consciousness travels with it, and the physical body is unconscious. Could you tell us how long we remain in the astral body after death, and what influences we are subjected to? Oh, a huge question, dear friends. I shall be lecturing on this subject later on, probably next year, if this branch wishes, and so could go into this. Depends on so many things, chiefly on the age of the person and their spiritual or material nature. Oh, so many factors that I dare not answer your question any further, except to say it depends upon the age of the body and the nature of the person. What centralizes the astral, mental, and ether bodies? The ego, the inner spiritual self. In its turn, the vehicle of the monad. And the last question, I believe. Yes, the last question. Can one see one's own chakras? Yes. Yes, possible. One of the experiences through which the trained clairvoyant passes, as their evolution and development proceeds, they begin to see their own chakra, particularly the one at the brow, through which the clairvoyant vision is employed. So yes to that question.